Welcome, friends, to Economic Update. Thanks to John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for that music. My name is Richard Wolff. I'm your host. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I earn my income teaching as a visiting professor in the graduate program for international affairs of the New School University in New York City. And I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org. Truthout is a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary every day. Let me, as always, thank you for your flood. That's what it is by now, a flood of questions and comments. I want to assure you that we read each one. We select the few that we can respond to on the time we have on the air, but we use the others to design and craft and organize our programs. So it's a way of actively participating on your part, and we are very grateful for your interest and for the contribution you make. Please, as always, send your questions and comments to me at my website, rdwolf.com. Easy to do, and we read them all. Today we're going to open with some updates that have a kind of semi-sweet, sad, and yet interesting quality to them. The first one has to do with France's most famous male actor, Gérard Depardieu, as they say it in France, who has been attracting quite a bit of attention since December of last year. And I wanted to tell you about it because there's some economic lessons here. Well, what did this famous actor, who has appeared in many, many films and has become extremely wealthy in France as a result, what did he do to become so famous and indeed to become controversial? Well, let's see. The big milestones were the following. On the 7th of December 2012, he relocated his official residence from France to a small village just across the French border with Belgium, so that now he is an official resident of Netchin in Belgium. Barely a week later, on the 15th of December 2012, Gérard Depardieu handed in and rejected his French citizenship and his French passport. 2 weeks after that, on the 3rd of January 2013, this year, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, announced that he had given the French actor Gérard Depardieu Russian citizenship and a Russian passport. What in the world is going on and how the world has changed? Well, let's see what the explanation for this bizarre sequence of events is. First, the socialist government of France this last summer, when it finally won all three elections for president, for the upper house of their legislature, the Senate, and for the lower house, the General Assembly, one of the first things the socialist government did was raise the income tax on the wealthiest French citizens from the existing rate that the conservatives imposed, 45%, to the new rate of 75%. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it meant that French people over a certain income, and let me tell you what it was, would have to pay this higher rate. All French people who earned 1 million euros or more would have to pay that amount of money. That is 75% of everything they earned over 1 million euros. And that works out to $1.3 million a year. And that, for those of you that are interested, works out to something on the order of $25,000 a week. So if you earn more than $25,000 a week, you would have to pay the higher rate on the money above $25,000 you earn, not on the first $25,000. In other words, the socialist government was making a splashy news story, but wasn't really affecting most French people, and it wouldn't have done much for the French government's finances. Would have helped it a bit, but it was more symbolic than anything else. Mr. Depardieu, being one of the tiny percentage of French people who earns that kind of money, wasn't happy. And he expressed his happiness by renouncing his French citizenship, by moving his residence to Belgium, and becoming a citizen of Russia instead. Why? Because unlike the 75% he would have to pay on his income over $25,000 a year, by moving to Russia, he could enjoy the Russian level of income tax, which is 13% of the money you earn per year, over $1.3 million worth. So there we have it. The former Soviet Union, socialist country, is providing a cheap haven for wealthy people from France who want to avoid paying the income tax share asked of them as the richest of French citizens. How the world changes. But the really interesting thing about this is that the number of individuals involved here is tiny. The percentage of French rich people who are going to leave France is tiny. This is a tempest in a teapot. It does reveal that the actor Depardieu leaves something to be desired in terms of a super rich person wanting to be more super rich than he already is. All of that's kind of crappy if you think about it. But there is a lesson here, which is that hiding your money in another country, either by not letting people know that you have it, or letting them know but changing your citizenship so you can hide from your tax man in a sort of semi-legal way, that's symbolically important, but it doesn't involve significant amounts of money. And that leads me to my second update for today, which is when real money is involved and it is being stashed in foreign countries, that exists, friends. But then we're talking about corporations. And that's coming up in the negotiations between the Republicans and Democrats. It has come up before. This time it comes up as follows. It turns out that American corporations who do a lot of business abroad have been holding the profits of their business abroad in bank accounts abroad. Why? Because they don't want to bring it home here to the United States, because if they do, they'll have to pay taxes on it, American taxes. So what they want to do is keep it abroad, pay taxes in some other country where the tax rates are lower. So, for example, the United States corporate tax rate is 35%. But the tax rate in Ireland, for example, and a lot of corporations, American corporations, use Ireland this way, the rate there is only 12.5%. In other words, it's a third of the rate paid if a company brings it home. Wow. This has led some Americans, particularly Republicans, but they're Democrats too, and there are media folks who support this, said the following: let's get that money home. Let's persuade. Notice they don't say force. Persuade. Coerce is not nice. So let us coax American corporations to bring their money home by offering them a special low rate to do that. And the one being proposed by many here in the United States who are leading the charge is 5.25%. In other words, instead of charging corporations the current legal rate of 35% on their profits, to get them to bring the profits home, something we could have required them to do, but instead of requiring them to bring it home and pay the full tax, we're going to induce them. We're going to give them a tax holiday and bring it home for merely 5.25%. And what's the argument for this? Oh, the backers of this say it's not because we want to give a big, fat tax cut to corporations, something we do not do for the mass of people. No. The argument is made, if they bring that money home, oh boy, will that be then money that they will use to expand production, to hire more workers. It's a good thing for everybody. Once again, that very special kind of argument where something very good for corporations is recast as good for everybody. Well, is it true? And the answer, as so often, is not at all. And let me explain why. We have experience with this. Back in 2004, this was done. Congress enacted a temporary tax holiday. And companies did indeed bring about 50% of their foreign cash. At that time, something like $360 billion back into the United States to take advantage of the temporary tax holiday. Did they use it to increase production? No. Did they use it to increase employment? No. Not only is that the case historically, but we have a study by the J.P. Morgan Bank in New York, as reported on the January 14th Time magazine. J.P. Morgan estimates that a tax holiday at the proposed rate of 5.25% would be a stimulus to raising stock market prices and little else in the United States. Why? Because the money coming back would be distributed to companies and to rich shareholders who would use it to play in the stock market. Well, the stock market is one of the few things in the American economy that has recovered over the last 3 or 4 years. The way the mass of people's financial and personal income and job situations have not recovered. So bringing this money home by giving them a chance to pay 5.25% rather than the 35% they ought to have paid will, in fact, boost the stock market and nothing else. But here's the worst of it. In a way, doing this is an incentive to corporations to do even more production abroad, to generate even more profits abroad, because they can keep the money there, either pay income taxes over there, or simply hold the money and wait for the next tax holiday when they can bring it home at a low rate. So ironically, it stimulates, it incentivizes moving production out of the United States because it appears that in the long run, the people who run this society will in this way, by a tax holiday, encourage the very thing they claim they don't want, which is the export of U.S. jobs. Is that a scandal? You bet. The third update for today I owe to a professor at the Dartmouth College Tuck School of Business. The professor, by name Sidney Finkelstein, has become famous as the author of about 11 books with titles such as Why Smart Executives Fail, Why Good Leaders Make Bad Decisions, and so on. Over the last 3 years, he has produced a list, and he calls his list the Worst CEOs of the Year. So I thought I would introduce you to people that Professor Finkelstein believes are the worst CEOs of 2012, the year just completed. I haven't the time to give you the whole list, but I thought I'd pick three of them. Why? Because I want to demystify the notion that the people who get to the top of our American corporations, or indeed of foreign corporations, are some kind of genius, some kind of entrepreneur of the year. No, they're not. They have the same collection of dumbos and deadheads that any other profession has in this society. and we should be aware of it, lest we slip into the feeling of imagining that those who arrive at the top of the business pyramid are any different from the rest of us. So here we go. Number one on his list this year, Brian Dunn. He resigned as the chief executive of Best Buy. Best Buy is that well-known chain of electronics superstores. Why did he resign? Well, he resigned in April of last year after allegations surfaced that he had had an inappropriate relationship with a subordinate. But that's not why he got on Finkelstein's list. Why did he? Because the stock price of the company has been collapsing. Because the same store sales were collapsing. Because the share of the market that Best Buy had was collapsing. Wow. Everything about that company collapsed. That was the achievement of that CEO. Second example, Aubrey McClendon, CEO of Chesapeake Energy. He was found to be a worst CEO of 2012 for some of the following reasons, cited by Finkelstein. Apparently, according to the Reuters News Service, Mr. McClendon borrowed as much as $1.1 billion over 3 years in undisclosed loans, backed up by the stake he personally had in thousands of the company's wells and a little $200 million oil and gas hedge fund that he had on the side. He also made use of the company jet and all kinds of other things that got him into serious trouble and his company, too. But I like, frankly, the third of the many that I've picked out, the third one. Rodrigo Rato, R-A-T-O, might be pronounced in English as Rato. In any case, he resigned as chairman of the Spanish bank Bankia in July of last year. He was a former finance minister in Spain and a former managing director of the International Monetary Fund, a very prestigious banker. And indeed, today we're going to have a number of things to say about prestigious bankers. He is currently under investigation in Spain for, get ready, fraud, price fixing, and embezzlement. In connection with Bankia's spectacular collapse, and get this, bailout by the Spanish government. Rodrigo Rato has an MBA from the University of California, Berkeley, Haas School of Business. In 2011, Bankia announced to the world that its annual profit was 309 million euros. After Rato resigned, there was an investigation, and the bank announced a restatement of its position. It didn't, in fact, earn 309 million euros. It lost 3 billion euros. That's how you get to be among the worst CEOs of the year. Last but not least, the heat is ratcheting up in Washington again. This time not over a so-called fiscal cliff, but instead over the debt ceiling limit. So let's get some perspective here. What's this about? Well, it turns out that every time the United States government borrows money, it does so against a limit to the total amount it can borrow that previous Congresses have voted. It's a way for Congress, each time it expands the allowed amount of borrowing, to say, okay, this much but no further, without an authorization by Congress to allow the government to borrow more than some fixed limit. And we are coming up against that limit. We've actually already reached it, but there are some financial adjustments that allow us another few weeks at most before the United States government runs out of money unless it is allowed to borrow more. And in order to borrow more, the ceiling, the limit on total amount of debt, has to be raised by the Congress. Last time this happened, the Republicans said they wouldn't do it unless there was cuts in spending, etc., etc. So the question is, do we really have to worry? And I thought you might be interested in this little historical reality. Between 1960 and August of 2011, the Congress voted 78 times to increase the debt limit. 49 of those times were under Republican presidents, and 29 times were under Democratic presidents. Whenever this issue came up, whichever party was out of power, whose member was not the president, they didn't want to raise the ceiling, and they made a big stink about it. When it was a Republican president, the Democrats made the stink. And when it was a Democratic president, the Republicans did. Get the picture? 78 times. Big noise made, big threat, and guess what happened each and every time? They voted in the end to raise the debt ceiling because they didn't want to collapse the credit of the United States, which would have collapsed if the United States was unable to repay its debts. And they didn't want to slow the government down, to get into the situation where any party would be blamed for the fact that soldiers and civil employees of the government didn't get their paychecks. So expect to hear a lot of noise, a lot of posturing, a lot of threats, and then a whimpering conclusion, rather like the fiscal cliff. Today we're going to be talking, as I mentioned earlier, about banks. And so here is another update that raises some more profound questions. From 2002 through 2010, Switzerland's oldest private bank was systematically and knowingly allowing rich U.S. taxpayers to evade their tax obligations to the United States by handling secret bank accounts. This long story, nearly a decade, finally came to an end in January of 2013 with a court agreement. In the Federal District Court in Manhattan, the bank in question, Wegelin and Company, a Swiss bank founded in 1741, agreed to pay fines of $74 million because it had systematically enabled American wealthy people to defraud the United States government by evading the taxes they were supposed to pay. What about this story? Well, here's the key thing to remember. The assets of this bank are in the neighborhood of $25 billion. So I did a calculation. If they paid a fine of $74 million and their assets are $25 billion, what was the percentage of their assets they had to pay in a fine? Less than one-third of 1%. This is called a slap on the wrist by a person who doesn't slap very hard. It's a joke. It will not discourage this kind of behavior. It's a way of saying, even if you're caught, even after you can fight it in the courts for years, all you'll get in the end is something that's trivial. And yet listen to the pompous statements of the United States attorney in Manhattan. Quote, "There is no excuse for wealthy Americans flouting their responsibilities as citizens of this great country." Notice, he has to put an adjective in front of country while he's making a statement about a case. "There's no excuse for citizens of this great country to pay their taxes, and there is no excuse for foreign financial institutions helping them to avoid paying their taxes." So said Preet Bharara, the United States attorney in Manhattan. Quote from him again. "Today's guilty plea is a watershed moment in our efforts to hold to account both the individuals and the banks." End of quotation. I can't read more of this quotation. The gap between what is being said and the reality is too terrible. But here is the charming part of this. This is an irritant for the Swiss bank, nothing more. This is a loss for the United States, that's for sure. This is a loss for all that will be done by other banks in the future. But the irritation of the bank in Switzerland was beautifully expressed by one of their executives, a man by the name of, I want to get it correctly here, Hummler, Mr. Hummler, H-U-M-M-L-E-R, who used to be the chairman of the Swiss Private Bankers Association. Wow, leading bank official. Here's what he had to say in his irritation about the United States bothering them with these silly fines for something that they believe all bankers do. I'm now going to quote to you from a statement made by Mr. Hummler, an official of the Wegelin Bank. Quote, and I'm reading, this was covered in the January 4th New York Times. The USA has fought by far the largest number of wars, sometimes with but mostly without a UN mandate, Mr. Hummler wrote. It has broken the international laws of war, maintained secret prisons, and fought an absurd war against drugs. A country, he continued, quote, whose underclass enjoys neither the benefits of an adequate education nor a halfway functioning healthcare system, a country whose economic system is increasingly inclined to overconsumption and in which saving and investment have increasingly become alien concepts, a situation that has undoubtedly been one of the driving forces behind the current recession, with all its catastrophic consequences for the whole world. Our Swiss banker friend, the British bankers would be capable of saying the same, but our Swiss banker friend is letting the United States have the full fury of his irritation at this puny interference with the normal way banks do their business nationally and internationally. We're now going to take our mid-program musical break. I will be back with you shortly. Welcome back to Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff, and we're now going to deal with some topics that indeed have been commented on or questioned by some of your communications through the rdwolff.com website. The first that I want to talk about today is to clarify the difference between Keynesian and Marxian economics. Quite a few of you are interested in that. So even though we have touched upon this from time to time, it's a difficult and complex area, so it's worth revisiting from time to time. The mainstream economic analysis that is taught in most American universities is called neoclassical economics. There's simply historical reasons why it has that awkward name. But it's basically a kind of celebration of capitalism, in which the argument is basically made that if you leave private individuals alone to own and accumulate as much property as they can, in any way that they can, and to deal with one another in a market relationship, buying and selling from one another, including their own capacity to work, lending and borrowing from one another, and so on, you will get the best possible economic outcome, a stable, prosperous, growing economic system. And on this basis, their celebration of capitalism makes arguments that it is efficient, that it is fair and just, and so on. From the beginning of capitalism's history, this rather rosy-colored view of capitalism has been contested. Today, 2013, the major two theories that contest, argue against, disagree with neoclassical or mainstream economics have two names. The two ones names are Keynesian economics, named after the British economist John Maynard Keynes, and Marxian economics, named after the German economist, although he did most of his adult work in England also, Karl Marx. So what's the difference? Keynes liked capitalism, just like the neoclassicals. His disagreement with them was that it was always a well-functioning, efficient, growth-oriented system. That, he thought, was stone-cold wrong. Capitalism, in Keynes's view, had a nasty tendency to periodically collapse, have an economic downturn. And you could call it a recession, a depression, a crisis, lots of words for it. But it is a regular feature of capitalism, and Keynes thought it had to be dealt with because it wasted people's lives, it wasted resources, and perhaps most seriously, it gave people pause in their acceptance of capitalism if it visited this economic catastrophe so often and so terribly on so many people. So Keynes came up with an explanation for why these cycles occur and for a solution. The government, Keynes argued, needs to, should intervene using its control over the money supply and using its control over the government's budget, taxing people and spending money, using these things, he called them monetary and fiscal policy respectively, the government should make sure that economic downturns, if they happen at all, are short and shallow, get reversed quickly, that the economy comes out of it without too many people being hurt for too long a time. That's Keynesian economics, the analysis of economic cycles and a set of policies government can take to either prevent them, which never really has worked, or at least to minimize them, to soften them, to moderate them. And that clearly has worked, at least sometimes. Marxian economics is altogether different. Marxian economics is not about cycles, even though Marx had some interesting things to say about why cycles occur. But Marx was very clear. Cycles go down and up. That's what a cycle is. The capitalist economic system is grossly inefficient in the way it throws people out of work and companies into bankruptcy, wasting resources, losing the output of society could and should make use of that it is capable of producing. Sure, he said all those things. But he pointed out that the economic downturns in capitalism eventually become upturns. That's just the way this system works. It is, as he put it, highly unstable. Marx's critique, then, was not about how can we come up with a government policy that makes it less terrible. Marx was much more concerned to raise a different question. Why do we tolerate, why do we accept an economic system with that kind of built-in instability? Why do we accept that it goes down so regularly? It's not an adequate answer, said Marx, that it then goes up, because when it goes up, then the only question is when will it turn down again, as it always has. And indeed, Marx went further. He said besides the instability of capitalism, there is a second dimension of it that makes us want to question it, to criticize it, and to insist that the human race can do better than capitalism. And that, Marx called exploitation, that feature of capitalism that for him was horrendous. And what is that? That's the situation in which the mass of workers produce by their labor more value than they are paid. You get the $20 an hour if and only if your work contributes more than $20 an hour to what your employer sells. Otherwise, there'd be nothing in it for himself. If you produce $20 worth and he pays you $20 for doing it, he gets nothing. He's not in the business of employing people to get nothing. The way capitalism works, he only prospers. He only profits if the workers produce more than they get. And in Marx's view, that's a fundamentally unfair, antagonistic arrangement of production. And no matter how you paper it over, it will sooner or later blow the system up and produce all kinds of crises, tensions, and social upheaval. So Marxian theory is a systematically critical approach to capitalism and its cycles. In contrast, Keynesianism is simply an argument that the cycles can and should be managed and an explanation of how the government can do that. I want to turn next to what many of you have also asked me about. What are the prospects for the U.S. and global economies in the year 2013, the year we're just now beginning? And I want to focus on a historical example and to suggest that from this historical example, we can make a reasonable guess about what's likely. Anything more than that would be silly, and I'm not here to pretend that I can predict the future. Nobody can do that. I can't either. But here's what I would like you to focus on. Starting in 2010, 2 years or more ago, a number of European countries decided that the way to cope with the economic crisis that we have in the global economy, these European countries would do two things. First, massively intervene with their governments, spend a lot of money to produce a stimulus, to bail out the banks, to bail out large corporations, and all the rest. And the way they would do it is to borrow a lot of money, which is what they did. And then, over the last 2 years, as they discovered that having borrowed a lot of money, their creditors, those who lend to governments, were getting nervous about the level of debt these governments had taken on, they decided to appease their creditors, to make them more confident about lending to these governments by showing their capacity to raise the money needed to pay the interest on all that government debt and to pay it back sooner or later. And how does a government do that? The answer in Europe was austerity. You raise taxes on your people to get more money into the government's hands, and you cut back government social programs so that the government doesn't have to spend on them so much and can use that money, together with the extra taxes they've raised, to pay off the creditors. The problem in Europe was that these austerity programs, and they were very harsh in places like Greece, Spain, Ireland, Hungary, Italy, Portugal, and I could go on. The problem was not only that the economies in these countries tanked, because if you tax people more, they have less to spend. And if the government spends less, well, that's less business for all kinds of companies and workers who used to sell to the government. So not only did the countries' economies tank, but the mass of people got very angry. We began to have demonstrations, protests, strikes, general strikes, coordinated first from city to city, then coordinated across an entire country, and twice over the last 2 years, once in 2011 and once in 2012, there were European continental-wide general and partial strikes and demonstrations. In short, the last 2 years have seen the greatest upsurge in mass protest against austerity policies and against capitalism as a system that Europe has seen in half a century. So now here comes my historical extrapolation. If borrowing a lot of money to bail out your banks and corporations contributed to the tumultuous year 2012 in Europe, if going deeply into debt in Europe contributed to the trouble, if imposing austerity as a way to deal with the debt caused incredible trouble. Then here's my thought for 2013 in the United States. We've done exactly the same thing. A major crisis, government bailout of banks and large corporations, government borrowing massively to pay for all of that, and now with the fiscal cliff deal reached last month in Washington, we have our own austerity program, rising taxes, and the government cut of social programs that's being worked out in Washington as we speak. Austerity American style. If all those conditions in Europe combined to produce major social upheaval, then my suggestion is watch out in 2013. We're going to have that here too. Sure, it'll take a particular form in the United States. It will correspond to our politics and our culture and our mindset in this country as compared to the different cultures and mindsets in other countries. But the basic pattern is unmistakable. And indeed, we saw in the late months of 2011 and the early months of 2012, we saw what was the first installment of exactly that, the Occupy Wall Street movement, protests against austerity, protest against the unfairness of who benefited from the government bailouts and who didn't. And then who's going to pay for all of that? And who gets away with not paying their fair of taxes the way we discussed at the beginning of the program? So, yes, I think history suggests that 2013 can well be a very historic turning point in American politics and society. Finally, let me cover one more topic before going to a couple of the most recent questions you have sent me. This one has to do with an analysis of markets. We keep returning to that because markets have been celebrated as if they were some quintessential invention of the human genius than which nothing could be better, something that works so beautifully and so efficiently that we should all thank our lucky stars that markets are the way we distribute resources on the one hand and finished goods and services on the other. That is a naive idea, and we really should outgrow it. Markets, like every other institution of human beings, has its strengths and has its weaknesses. It has its flaws. It has its problems. And to pretend that they're not there is counterproductive at best and simply foolish at worst. So let's review what a market does. A market is a way of deciding who gets whatever it is we produce as a society. So, for example, if there are more people who want ice cream cones than there are ice cream cones in any market at any time, a market in a quarter of a town, a market in a city, a market in an entire country, wherever the market be, however large it is, if we confront a situation where the buyers outnumber the sellers, the buyers want more than the sellers have to sell, what does a market do? A market distributes scarce goods to those with the greatest ability to pay. So suppose you and I both want an ice cream cone, but there's only one. More buyers than sellers. I have $1,000 in my pocket. You have $100 in your pocket. What happens? Well, I go to the ice cream guy, and I say, I'd like that ice cream. I'll pay you, well, let me ask you, what are you charging? Oh, $2? I'll offer $5. Ooh, you don't want to lose the ice cream. You offer $10. Fine, I say. I offer $20. You see where this game is going? At a certain point, we're going to get to $100. And I'm going to smile and say, I offer $105. And I'm smiling because I know you don't have 105. You only have 100. You can't play anymore. I get the ice cream for $105. In other words, what markets do is distribute goods and services to those who have the most to pay for them. The market doesn't inquire how you got that money. Did you work for it? Did you find it? Did you inherit it? Market doesn't care. The market rewards those who have the money by providing, and it punishes those who don't by withholding. Do you want to accept a market? Do you want to believe that's a reasonable way to distribute goods and services in a society based on how much you have without regard to how you came by it? Whether it's a reasonable arrangement to give some people a lot and other people very little? Every major religious institution in the world today has had major problems with markets. In the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church was critical of markets, precisely on the grounds that they rewarded the rich and punished the poor. They believed in something the Roman Catholic Church did called the just price. They didn't want the market to set the price because it wasn't just, as in justice. Wow. Markets are a system of distribution, and they ought to be discussed and evaluated the same way we evaluate any other institution in our society. Turning to your questions, I want to thank Gerard Cote, who allowed us to use his name, who sent in a question this month, and it goes to what happened to the capital gains tax in the deal arrived at by the Republicans and the Democrats, Obama and Boehner, at the beginning of the year in the famous fiscal cliff deal. Here's the answer. For couples earning under $450,000 a year, nothing much changes. They can still pay a lower rate of taxes on their capital gains and dividends, precisely 15%, than is paid by Americans who work for a living, who depend on wages and salaries. Because if you earn above a pretty low level, $30,000, $40,000 a year, you have to pay a much higher rate than 15%. In other words, the American tax system for people earning under $450,000 a year privileges the income you get in the form of capital gains and dividends over the income you get from working for a living. It's an interesting decision to privilege that. Why? Because capital gains and dividends are income you earn because of the property you own. You will get that income whether you do a minute's worth of work in a year or not. If you own shares of stock, you get dividends. Has nothing to do with what you do as work or whether you work at all. And the same is true with capital gains. Those are the difference between what you pay for a share of stock or a bond and what you sell it for at some later point. If the value has gone up between buying and selling, the difference, the gain you've earned, is a capital gain. So this government of ours taxes the income from property at a much lower rate than it taxes the income from labor. That's good for those who own the property, a tiny percentage own most of it, and bad for those who work for a living. That's the vast majority. And I leave it to you to explain why we would have a tax system organized in this way. All that the agreement reached by Obama and Boehner in the beginning of January did was to say that those who earn more than $450,000 a year will now have to pay not the 15% that used to be the bill, tax bill for capital gains and dividends, and not the 15% that is still going to be the case for those who earn under $450,000 a year. These wealthier people who earn more than $450,000 a year will have to see it go up to 20% from 15%, still way below what your simple average American working family has to pay as a percentage on the income it gets from the labor it does, because that's its only source of income. Final point. What's the justification for this? The old idea that we have to favor those who have property because if we don't, they won't invest the money. The Federal Reserve reports that today, ready? Today, corporations and wealthy people are sitting on trillions of dollars. They are not investing. Unless the government taxes spends it for them, they'll just sit on it. And if they sit on it, they're not buying anything and they're not creating any jobs. And if the government taxes it and uses it to spend and build in the economy, it will provide purchases and it will provide jobs. That's the real issue. Everything else is a smokescreen. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Ha ha ha.